Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
Welcome back, Warrior Next Door listeners. This is our final installment of our conversation with Donald Miller, where he talks about not just developing as a young writer, but his, the arc of his career that led him to being on a, to having people like Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg on his speed dial, people that he worked with in a variety of ways outside of Masters of the Air. And you'll hear the origin stories of that. How Masters of the Air got chosen to be part of the World War II trilogy produced by Hanks and Spielberg. So join us.
That is the idea, the unrolling of the story. And that's the secret, too, to another one of the more difficult things about writing narrative history. And that is, how do you incorporate interpretation into narration without slowing the narration and making it really soupy? Here also, I think Tuckman provides some good ideas. Just tell the story as it happened. And the interpretation will kind of creep up on you and tap you on the shoulder and say, here I am. The interpretation's in the story. If the story is told right, you get all the facts right. You get all the controversy in there, the debates and things like that. And you'll see that you're writing from a point of view. The way you organize a book is an act of interpretation. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? I think that's really important that, you don't have to say, I believe this in declamatory prose or anything like that. But the way you organize it is an interpretation.
Is your background, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to ask you, is your background primarily in history or in writing? Because you strike me as someone who was academically trained to be a writer. But you're a historian and you teach history. How has that worked for you? I mean, how did you get?
I would say I was more oriented toward writing, and I went to a small Benedictine college called St. Vincent College. It was a really nice school for me because I wasn't ready for anything bigger than that. And I had some great instructors, and I was drawn to philosophy, actually. And my favorite subject was logic and putting things together. I loved it. I got my highest grades in logic. I really concentrated on it. And I carried that over into organizing papers and things like that. I could, with my philosophy background, I was organizing things much better, and I could see that I was doing that. And so that was really important to me. Outlining was hugely important to me.
Allows you to structure your thoughts.
Well, I was afraid when I started writing because I didn't have much confidence. As a high school student, I was an athlete more than a student. And when I went to college, I was pretty much of an asshole. And I got straightened out pretty fast by a guy who was a very good athlete himself, who happened to be my history teacher, and the kind of history teacher who didn't lecture and things, but just discussed history and sent you to the library and things like that, and told you you're gonna get smarter by reading. and you better start right now because you're behind. You're way behind, buddy. And I remember sitting at a bar in Greensburg, Pennsylvania with a buddy of mine, and we were just getting into being young intellectuals. And I turned to him and I said, you know, John, what are we going to do when we have finished reading all the good books? You talk about pretension. You talk about two sober at the time, two absolute idiots, you know.
Well, then you write your own awesome books, right?
I'll never forget that conversation. And he, who was as stupid as I was, looked at me and he said, yeah, I think of that all the time. What are we going to do when we run out of books?
So what I love about this is by this point in the interview, it's not even an interview anymore. It has ceased being an interview. It probably started before that.
It's just a conversation.
It's a great conversation between three people who have an appreciation and love for history, preserving it and sharing it is what it comes down to. That's what we're doing. And I just thought it was so cool to see him drop his guard and tell us a story about, you know, when you're young, you think that way. You think, I can remember.
Yes.
I can remember as a young scientist being afraid that there'd be no more scientific endeavors for me, that all the answers have happened, that everything associated with geology was known. And now here I am 22, 23 years into this, and I realize that we don't know anything.
That's right. Isn't that funny? Isn't that funny that the more you know, the less you
know? Exactly. That's kind of where he's going. And so I wanted to share this clip with our audience because it's a real gift. If you're listening to this right now, you either are a Donald Miller fan or maybe you'll become one. But I don't think you're going to run into a lot of interviews about authors of his caliber who are as well known as him, where he's going to kind of, you know, open up like that and share some of the pretensions that he had and all the, he called himself an asshole when he was going to college. I mean, I just thought it was great.
So one of the things I thought was rather poignant with him was how he talked about a very influential professor, teacher that he had early on. And that was that history teacher that told him, buddy, you don't know anything.
You're way behind. You know?
And you're way behind. But, you know, I think we all can point to someone if you've gone to college or even if you haven't, but you had a great teacher in high school, someone who lit a fire in you, right? Someone who probably enlightened you in a way you're like, I didn't realize I liked that subject, you know? And, you know, I had a physics teacher in junior college that was, I took physics one, didn't do that great in physics one, took physics two, and he was the best teacher, I think one of the best teachers I've ever had. And he was in a junior college, but he was very good at explaining, like making the experiments, the labs entertaining, and it was a discussion, and it was a performance every day. You know, it was really captivating stuff. And I credit him for giving me the interest and the confidence to go into more of a physics oriented career. So anyway, what about you, Tony?
No, I have those teachers in my life as well. Mr. Sebelak, physics teacher, Mr. Carl Bruder, who was a geoscience teacher I had early on. These individuals, when they can impart, you know, they ignite that passion in something that you didn't know you had before. I think what we're talking about is I don't think you went into physics class thinking you're going to love physics. I think you were probably thinking, I need two semesters.
I was like, oh man, this is the second semester. I didn't do too hot.
Exactly.
In the
first one. I took geology as just kind of, I don't know. But when people can ignite that passion in you, those people are special. And he just talked about one of those. He mentioned a guy by name that they weren't even drunk and they were making, you know, things that drunk people would say
and,
about all the books being read.
Well, and look at the course that it set him on from one professor.
Oh, and so
he's one of the preeminent historians of World War II now.
Perfect segue, Rhino. So the next clip is that course. So here, you know, How we just heard some clips about his writing, about his early days, about realizing that he was deficient in a number of things that he needed to get better at. And this next clip is going to talk about how all that has bore fruit.
Donald, I think that's a great segue, because here you are talking about the early version of you, who was, you know, maybe had some confidence issues, wasn't sure you're going to become a good writer. And now you are days away from having one of your books featured on a Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks collaboration. Could you tell our audience how an author gets approached to have their book become a huge miniseries on Apple TV? How does that work? What does that look like?
I don't know. I really don't know.
I really don't know.
Yeah. But I, you know, in answer to your question, I don't know. You know, I mean, you keep plugging away. Yeah. And Dave McCullough, who was a very close friend of mine, he kept telling me that my books did have cinematic potential. But I kind of got the taste for it when The American Experience made a television series out of my Chicago book. And that was big. And then Lou Rita and the History Channel and other channels started to make short features, an hour and things like that, and did a show on Night of the Long Knives. And we did before this, we did a film called The Air War, which is a really good film, I think. And it's about the 100th Bomb Group. So I was confident I could do it. And I was glad for the opportunity. I just needed to be close to people who believed in me, you know. Propinquity, as they say, you know. I mean, just getting, being in the right spot, you know. Mm-hmm. It's fortunate. I owe that to the World War II Museum, because I was very close friends with Stephen Ambrose. And Steve and I both published with Simon & Schuster. And one day Steve said, "Hey, I'm opening a museum." I said, "You got to be kidding me." And because he was the most disorganized guy in the world. But he had a guy named Nick Mueller who was unbelievably organized and a real businessman as well as an historian. And so I went down to the opening, and I met Hanks and Spielberg there and a lot of other people. And I got associated with the museum. Steve brought me in as a consultant, and met other historians, and widened my range and things like that, and put me around a really good group of people, and so that placed me in a position, at least, to meet people like Hanks and Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but did they send you an email someday saying, "Hey, let's get the band back together"? I mean, what does it look like? You are an accomplished writer in your own right, a New York Times bestseller. And I've watched some of the other movies that are based on work you've done. So you're already a thing. But it's kind of like, you know, holy crap. I mean, Steven Spielberg's a thing as well. What was it like when?
Well, yeah, I don't know exactly. I remember getting a phone call one time from Playtone Studios, and there's a guy there named Kurt Sadusky who kind of runs the place. And McCullough was down there. They were going to make a film of his book on the early days of the American Revolution in Boston Harbor. And McCullough put Kurt on the phone and told him that, you know, he really ought to be working with me. And Kurt said, "I've read all his books, you know, and the time is going to come." And then when they started the Pacific, I was really occupied with a lot of stuff, family stuff, and sickness in the family. And then when they got along, Tom called me, Hanks called me and said, "We're having a problem with this Pacific thing."
Okay. I want to stop it really here really quick, and then we'll continue on to the next clip. He has been involved and has been best friends with Ambrose, helping establish the World War II Museum. You're about to hear how he got involved with the miniseries The Pacific. He got to meet people like Hanks and Spielberg and McCulloch. I mean, you got this young athletic kid who goes to school and thinks he's read all the good books, and now, you know, 20, 30 years later, he's doing this thing, which is absolutely amazing. And the odyssey continues.
The individual parts are really good, but the connectives are sometimes missing. How do you get the reader from Guadalcanal to Gloucester and on to Okinawa, or from Iwo Jima to Okinawa? That's hard for the reader to fathom because the war is so vast geographically and things like that. And how do you make the connections? And I said, yeah, it is a problem. And I had done a book called D-Days in the Pacific. And he said, well, come on down here and help us. And so that's how I got started, you know, working with them on connecting all of the various parts of the puzzle. And they'd send up to Easton. I didn't have to travel much. They'd send up to Easton, almost a guy who was like a stenographer. And we'd sit for hours and he'd take notes and I'd kind of muse about how to do things. And then we'd have long conversations with the writers and the producers. And that was when I really started to get into it. And then after that, we started to make a film about that was going to showcase the museum. This was after we suffered a horrible hurricane in New Orleans, you know, Katrina, and it almost went under. And we're looking for a way to pull ourselves back up. And Nick Mueller decided to gamble big time. And Nick is really the star of the show. And he said, we're going to go big. We're going to build a theater. And we're going to do a tremendous film, unlike any that had been done before, in a multiplex theater and using the Disney company. And we're going to raise the money and pull it off. And we did. And I got involved in that. And a lot of our work took us to California, where the Disney studios were, because we had some moving parts, seats that shook and, you know, fake snow and all this other stuff. Hanks was the advisor on the film, and he really helped us a lot. It wasn't just, you know, him coming in and taking a quick look at things. I mean, he would come in and critique it and things like that. And he mentioned to me there that, you know, he'd like to work with me, and that he was thinking up the line of something along the lines of, as he put it at the time, his dad was in the Navy. He said, my dad hated the Navy, but I still like to do the Navy. But, you know, he was thinking of the tin can soldiers and maybe combine that with the Air Force. But then how do you connect them? And I said, you know, you don't connect them. That's too much of a stretch and things like that. And that's where we left it. And then one day I got the call. And so he said, we're going to do it just on the Air Force.
Amazing, is it, to hear the narrative, the history behind his role in helping to save the World War II Museum after Katrina completely stopped any foot traffic for the better part of a year. And I was just at that museum, this is my third or fourth time. Ryan, I know you've been there several times too. Mm-hmm. With my wife, my boys were in New Orleans. This is where the museum is. My boys were celebrating their 21st birthday. They were not able to make it with us because it was too early in the morning. But we went, sat in the theater. It's that 4D experience and all that. And yeah. I mean, what would it be like to work with Ambrose and all these amazing people to not only have that sort of an institution become viable and beautiful, but then at the same time you're working on films and hanging out with Tom Hanks and these guys? How cool is that?
Oh, I mean, it's everybody's dream that is interested in this subject and has this sort of, you know, I guess viewpoint and stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, I was surprised to hear that they were wrestling with, you know, with the Pacific miniseries, that they were wrestling with that whole issue of it being such a widespread battlefront, you know. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people out there that have seen Band of Brothers and the Pacific can, that, you know, you have your own, everybody has their own opinion on which one's better. You know, I think a lot of people, Band of Brothers is everyone's favorite because it set this, it's really the high wall, you know, that sets the stage for how you want these things to unfold, you know. But with Pacific, you followed three different individual men, not even in the same unit, you know. And I always felt like that the character building, the building of the characters suffered a bit in the Pacific, because with Easy Company, it was basically built around Dick Winters leading the whole thing, and all the guys were in his unit. So they were all in the same spot all the time. They're all fighting. They all know each other and everything. And with the Pacific, it was great that it was three individual stories based on three individual experiences. But he's right. It was a bit disjointing to go from, you know, Peleliu to Guadalcanal to Cape Gloucester, and you know, Australia and all over the place. People just aren't as familiar with that geography, as they are in Western Europe. So anyway, kind of a little bit off topic with it, but I just felt like that was interesting, you know, that he brought that up and that they were aware of it back then. Getting to Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, which I think what he was referring to, we both perked up when he said that, like, That is a story that we've all said, oh my gosh, this needs to be made into a Band of Brothers style, you know, miniseries, because it can't be done in a single movie. I mean, a 2-hour movie is just not enough time to convey. I mean, you're cramming too much information into one thing. And I think that the Battle of Leyte Gulf is the most epic. It's the last naval battle that's occurred, you know, especially it was the largest, the craziest. I mean, and that's one facet of it, you know? I mean, there's so much to
it. It was the last largest naval engagement in world history. It was the last time battleships fired guns at each other in anger. It was one of the few times in the history of World War II where an aircraft carrier took direct fire from a capital ship on the enemy. Usually the carriers were too far away for that. You never saw. What do you always hear about Coral Sea and Midway and all that? The opposing forces never saw each other except for the airplanes. Well, that didn't happen. And just a little bit more of a plug for the book, Last Stand of Tin Can Sailors. It was written by James Hornfisher, the late James Hornfisher. I'm sad to say he died way too young. I think in his early 50s, maybe late 40s, of cancer. I was doing a reunion. I was invited to a reunion in Austin, Texas. It was the last reunion for the USS New Orleans. We mentioned in our podcast that those interviews, we're just trying to find a way. In the same way that Hanks and others struggled with trying to tie all those disparate things together in the Pacific, Ron and I are finding a hard time trying to figure out what do we do with 24 interviews on one ship. But at any rate, we went to a museum in Fredericksburg, great museum, because that's where Nimitz harkens from. That's his hometown. So it's a Nimitz museum. And James Hornfisher found out about it and asked to be invited because he was doing research for a book on some of those battles, those cruiser actions in and around Guadalcanal and Iron Bottom Sound that the USS New Orleans was a part of. And he was awesome. He was amazing. He was sitting down, interviewing these veterans, having a chance to talk to them. And I couldn't agree with Ryan more. I don't think there's another narrative about a single naval battle that has captured, that has pulled me in as much. And if you think about it, Ryan, I've talked about this. Band of Brothers, you've got the war, ETO, land war, and then you've got the Pacific, which is the Marines and the Army, mostly the Marines. And then now you have the air war in Europe. Why not have a naval action in the Pacific that is done up in the Spielberg, Hanks manner? It would be fantastic. It's an amazing story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
I agree. And I think my hope is that since he brought that up, that perhaps that is on the horizon. Maybe that will happen. If Tom Hanks brought it up in a conversation with Donald Miller, it's good to know that those guys are aware of it. And they consider it worthy of a storytelling, obviously.
Ryan, you ready for me to say something that will cause us to lose more of our audience? Because I'm about to do it.
It's a common occurrence, Tony. Go for it.
My only wish and desire is that Disney does not do it, that they do not do a single movie on Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailor. I don't want a bunch of fluffy-ass love stories. I don't want a bunch of crazy cowboys flying into combat. You know, yeah, John Wayne in it. I want it. It needs to be done seriously. It needs like a Hank Spielberg-type treatment. And I think I agree with you, Ryan. I don't think I know I agree with you that it should be a miniseries. It can't just be a movie. But
there are too many of these awesome stories that you just can't cram into a two-hour movie. It's got to be done as a miniseries, or if not an entire season, you know, or you know, for a series, you know, more than 9 episodes, like Masters of the Air, Band of Brothers, more like a 15 episoder. But that's a budget. These are big time, almost movie sort of series that we're seeing just in 9 parts, you know. So, yeah, I mean, we all know stories, and we have our own favorite stories we'd love to see made into a Steven Spielberg Hanks series. I think Spearhead, Adam Makos's book Spearhead, would be just epic. You know, it'd be like Fury, but way better.
Yeah, and Disney
with true totally stories.
Disney, stay the hell away from our awesome history stories. Stick to your freaking cartoons and leave like the proper history to the adults in the room. There, I've lost some of our audience.
You've lost all the Disney listeners.
All three
okay
of them. So. Oh my gosh, I'm so disappointed in how. So, okay. All right. Move on. We've got 2 clips left. I don't know. We'll just kick them. Go ahead, Rhino.
And I was told later by Kurt Sadowski that they were all sitting around one day talking about this very thing, what exactly to do, when Spielberg walked in with my book and said, "This is the book we're going to do."
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was it. And he's the boss. So, yeah. That's the story that I heard. And I believe it, you know.
You know,
what's it like working? Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, real quick, I was just going to say, you know, there's Band of Brothers, which is, you know, something that has become a hugely impactful miniseries. Yes. Some people, you know, with the timing of it being released right around September 11th, 2001, a lot of people, you know, I think really looked at that miniseries as a huge boost of patriotism. And it brought a lot of people back to the history of World War II.
It did, yeah.
And then you go from the European theater to the Pacific with the miniseries of Pacific and now the air war. Your book being one of the trilogy so far, hopefully there's more of these that Hanks and Spielberg do. It has to be immensely, you know, satisfying to know that you've been inducted into this storyline, this narrative for our culture.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to add about Masters of War for our audience that they should keep an eye on, or that you're particularly proud of when this miniseries drops, and we can kind of leave it there?
Well, I think, you know, it's fidelity. I think it's the whole idea of being true to the actual experience and not having to make things up. Mm-hmm. You have to place in your mind the idea that everything you're watching actually happened. That this is not a documentary, but at the same time, it's not a movie either. It's a movie that's really solidly based on documentary evidence. And there are very few movies exactly like that. At every turn, we made the decision to do it as it happened, to the exact character that it happened to. There are certain exceptions in there. One of the characters, Biddick, isn't a big character in my book. Some of the women aren't characters at all. There are little changes, but by and large, you know, it's overwhelmingly true to the experience of the war, as close as we could pull it off.
Well, I just signed up for HBO. I'm sorry, HBO, but Apple TV to be able to watch this. I know a lot of other people are.
Yeah.
You are immensely gracious for taking the time with us today.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was a good day. I got the new, we have a beautiful new cover on the book, and I got the book in the mail today. It's really pretty.
Yeah. Awesome. And I mean, I know that you're going to be really busy. You're inundated right now, I'm sure, with people that want to interview you and talk to you as this debut date approaches. But, you know, do you think maybe later this summer when things are going, do you think we could kind of reconnect with you and maybe get your thoughts?
Hey, that'd be fun. Please. That'd be fun. Sure. Oh. Let's do it.
Oh, that's like the highlight of the entire interview is he's going to be back on the freaking Warrior Next Door that we didn't scare him away. So if we go back earlier in the clip, I thought it was funny, Ryan. You did this amazing job of setting up this, hey, you are part of like World War II canon. You are part of this trilogy.
Yeah.
What do you think? I didn't cut that out. All he had to say was, yeah, that was it.
That's all.
So,
part of me is like, oh, wow, that was a complete dud of a question. I mean, I spend 30 seconds getting it out. And he goes,
yeah. I mean, so for the audience, like, oh. It sounded abrupt and I left it in there because I just thought it was interesting that, look, the bottom line is this is a big deal. He's got to know it's a big deal. And Ryan's.
Well, and he sounds like he's a humble
and
guy.
And that's where
he
I'm going.
Like he's trying.
He's basically kind of like, yeah, I mean, this is really cool, but he's not going to thump his own chest. I'd still be thumping my chest over that question, but that's just me, not him. And then we hear the origin story of how Spielberg comes into a meeting with Hanks and a bunch of producers with his book, with Donald Miller's book, Masters of the Air, and he sets on a table and he said, this is our next movie. Oh, that is so badass. And you heard it here.
And like he said, he's the guy. He's Spielberg's the man in charge. So that's fantastic.
Yeah. So
I couldn't imagine having my work, immortalized, by Steven Spielberg and, alongside Band of Brothers of Stephen Ambrose and The Pacific, which was written by Hugh Ambrose, Stephen Ambrose's son. You know, I mean, it's the ultimate compliment for a professional. And I would think he would be and I'm sure he is extremely gratified and fulfilled that at this point in his life, this is where he's at. And what a fantastic story.
And well deserved. This book should be the basis for this series. This to me is canon now for the 8th Air Force Air War, not just the 8th Air Force, the 15th and the 8th, basically the air war over Europe during World War II. And the other thing you mentioned at the end was how so just really quick, when I was calling him to set this interview up, he kind of talked a little bit about, oh, I got this new cover coming in today. I'm so excited about it. I was like, yeah, okay, that's great. Now, what about the interview with us? and then here we are, we're talking to him, and he's still, that cover came in. He's really excited about it. I've got the old cover, from the original book, but I'm going to have to go on Amazon and see what this new cover is. Apparently, it is Donald L. Miller approved. So, any rate, we've got one more clip left, and then we'll wrap this one up, Rhino.
It's a great pre-dinner conversation.
Well, great.
Fantastic.
And the fact that we did it as a conversation was extra special.
Great.
And that's how we like to do things. And not only that, our audience who loves these oral histories, you use them so masterfully. It's just fantastic. Can't wait to watch it next week. We're letting everyone we know. But we don't need to because it's going to be a hit and we can't wait to see it. And thank you again for the books that you write and for this role, this new thing, this new canon that we'll have with the movies associated with this, with World War II. So thank you, Donald. We appreciate it.
Yeah. And tell them that we're doing podcasts after every episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm going to be joining those and we'll put those on our Facebook page and our website as well.
We have the actors, set directors, Hanks himself, Kurt Zdusky and I host it. So we have that. And it's going to be great. Yeah.
We're planning on having Marilyn Walton back on our podcast. She was a guest host with us on a series we did.
So anyway, she speaks very highly of you, and I can see why. You're a great guy. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. Have a good evening.
Okay, you too.
I enjoyed this a lot. I really did.
All right.
Thank
Take
you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Did you hear that? He said he enjoyed it a lot. He said he enjoyed it.
Oh, my gosh.
Back in- we sound like schoolgirls, Tony.
Hey, I'm telling you, this guy is a freaking amazing writer.
Yeah,
and I can't, you know, look, The Warrior Next Door, the podcast is doing well, right? We're not Joe Rogan. You know, we're never going to get, you know, a million people listening to us every day. And the reason for that is because the people that are drawn to history podcasts are kind of niche-y. It's interesting. Ryan and I just interviewed somebody who is an author, an interviewer, an amazing individual who also knows Marilyn Walton. His name is Colin Heaton. And we were both talking, and we'll drop that interview later. We're still doing the edits on it. We were talking about how when you go and look at, you know, whether it's podcasts or movies or anything, you know, history is pretty niche-y. It doesn't get the worldwide acclaim that you're going to see from, you know, YouTube influencers, or, you know, Joe Rogan, who has found a way to make this incredible podcast.
Or unboxing videos, like how to unbox different toys with nice fingernails, you know, while you do it.
Okay, come on, Ryan. Let's just be honest with ourselves and the audience. How have you run into some sort of huge YouTube or podcast that gets, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of subscribers, and you look and it's like, what the hell is this crap? I mean,
the dude that does the Minecraft stuff. I mean, there's a guy that, yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I'm saying? I mean, I'm just, yes. It's not that I don't want people to be entertained. It's just that here we have shared with the audience firsthand personal accounts of entire civilizations, entire countries being laid low, like the Nazi regime, because of how history was manipulated. It ends up being the most important topic that a civil society can have when it comes to understanding their narrative, their place in the world, and how they interact with other countries and each other. And yet, it's a niche thing. We'll always be a smaller podcast, and I'm okay with that, because this podcast has allowed us to connect with like-minded individuals who care about these things, and has allowed us to be able to have an interview with my favorite author, Donald Miller, and hopefully a repeat one with him and Marilyn Walton. And Ryan, if that's the only thing that happens as this podcast continues to grow, and it does continue to grow, I'll be happy with that.
Yeah, so far we've been very happy with how our podcast has gone, and you know, just having access to some of these great people is like you said, it's a blessing to us. It's you know, we hope that it makes for interesting listening for all of our listeners out there too. So well, I think that kind of wraps it up. Do you have any other things you want to mention here, Tony?
No, I'm just going to warn the audience. I always wrap up the shows with a caw, and this one's going to be really freaking loud. So, Ryan, bring us home.
I'm afraid now I'm going to take my headphones off for this one. So, all right. Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening. You know, we are so blessed, so privileged to have you guys all out there listening to us and coming to us for interesting stories and everything. My name is Ryan Fairfield.
And I'm Tony Lupo.
And we will catch you next time. We may have to bleep that one out. I don't know.
Oh, dude. And this concludes our conversation with Donald Miller. We hope you enjoyed it. I know we did. He's one of the great historians of the 21st and 20th centuries. Please check out his books. He's got many of them. My two favorites are, you know, Masters of the Air and History of World War II. In addition to that, his series is being broadcast on Apple TV. I should say a series based on his book. And after each series is dropped on Friday, there's a podcast that you can check out where Donald Miller is the recurring guest, and they unpack a little bit about each episode. So you can access the link to that podcast on our website at thewarriornextdoor.com, and we look forward to seeing everybody next week. Take care.